properties. I'm going to hopefully talk about that for about 10 minutes. Then I'm going to spend the majority of the talk discussing an interpretational issue and the so-called anhomomorphic logic that was thought up by Raphael Sorkin sitting over here. I'm going to apply this to the Kokenspecker theorem. So first, I'm going to give you a quick introduction to the histories approach. What is a histories approach? Well, it's really an entire attitude to quantum mechanics in which histories are fundamental rather than states. So if you think back to the double slit setup that Owen mentioned, the actual, which I'll draw for you. If you think back to the double slit setup that Owen mentioned, here you had roughly two possible paths. In the standard approach, you would really think of the state as fundamental. In the space-time approach, you would think of these two paths, A and B, as fundamental. You talk about the properties of the paths. You would phrase the dynamics in terms of the paths. This is akin to, or the way I will deal with it, is akin to classical stochastic dynamics. And so in that light, any histories theory has the following structure. You've got a sample space of omega of possible histories. So in this case, you've got the two possible paths, A and B. You then have an event algebra, A, whose elements are the possible questions that can be asked about the system. Now, this is the analog of the set of measurable functions in probability theory. If omega is finite, this is just a set of subsets of omega, also called 2 to the omega. In the infinite case, you may have to make some restrictions, so it might not be the entirety of 2 to the omega. A is an algebra under symmetric difference, which acts as addition, and intersection, which acts as multiplication. And that algebraic structure will be important when we come to the interpretational issue. Does everyone know what symmetric difference is? If you don't, if you have two sets, A and B, symmetric difference is exclusive OR, the shaded region. And finally, stop waving this threateningly. Finally, every theory will have a dynamics which can be expressed either in terms of the decoherence functional, which some of you may be familiar with, or the quantum measure mu, which I will introduce. I'm going to give you an example from ordinary quantum mechanics. However, I've got to stress that this approach can be used to generalize and discuss things that you can't always write down in the Copenhagen formulation. So we've got here two possible paths. Say we have two particles going from the initial state to the final state. You can think of this as space-time. Path alpha, we know that at time one, this path crosses alpha one. At time I, the green path is on alpha I. At time I, the blue path is at beta I. So how do we represent this in quantum mechanics? Well, we start with the initial state. We operate on that with a class operator to get the final state, depending on the history. What is this class operator? Well, you firstly evolve from the initial state to time one, using the Schrodinger equation, using whatever the dynamics is going on. Then we know that at time one, we are at alpha one, so we project onto that value. Again, we evolve, again, we project, again, we evolve, again, we project. This gives us a history. We act on all of this on the initial state, and we end up with the final state pertinent to this history. Similarly, if we put betas in here instead of alphas, we would get the final state pertinent to this history. As I said, this is an example from which I'm going to call standard quantum mechanics. You can accommodate more general theories, for example, stochastic collapse. So how do we talk about the dynamics here? Well, we're going to use a decoherence functional. This is a map from the event algebra across itself to the complex numbers. It's Hermitian. The map is going to be linear. This is disjoint unions, the union of two disjoint sets. And it's going to be unital. These properties define the decoherence function. What is it in this case? Well, when you use this for standard quantum mechanics, the d of the history alpha and the history beta is simply the interference term, the cross term between the final state you would get if you had gone through history beta and the final state you would get if you go through history alpha. So you can think of the decoherence functional as a large matrix. The diagonal terms of which The diagonal terms of which are going to be squared sums. The off-diagonal terms are going to be interference terms. So now I'm going to move on to talk about collapse models. So what are collapse models? How are they motivated? Again, as Owen mentioned, there is this what we call the measurement problem. Some people, including myself, we feel there's a need for an objective theory of measurement, objective theory of collapse, objective theory of emergent classicality, whatever you call it. Stochastic collapse is a proposed solution. Very roughly, there are spontaneous partial collapses occurring stochastically chosen locations, which aggregate to an almost complete collapse on the macroscopic classical level. How does this work out in practice? So let's compare standard quantum mechanics to stochastic collapse. Standard quantum mechanics, you have complete collapse, also called sharp measurements. Mathematically, this is represented by projectors. Stochastic collapse, you have only partial collapse occurs. This is sometimes gets called unsharp measurements, use Krauss operators. I think I've got time to go into that. In standard quantum mechanics, you have Schrodinger equation evolution, and then you have collapse upon measurement, or at least this is how I'm gonna present it. In stochastic collapse, we have Schrodinger equation evolution, and you have spontaneous collapses that occur. Now, the canonical example is the GRW model. What happens here? Upon collapse, your state, psi, is essentially acted on by this J matrix, this Krauss operator, and you have an unsharp measurement or a partial collapse. This is just a normalization factor. So what is this J? Well, really, you're hitting it with a Gaussian centered around Y. Or x minus y. This y, the collapse center, is chosen randomly. This is the spatial location of the collapse. The time of the collapse is also chosen randomly according to a Poisson process. So essentially, you have two processes occurring here. You have Schrodinger evolution, and then you have the choice of collapse centers. This is a quantum process, this is stochastic. So I'm going to show you very briefly, we're going to put this onto a lattice and we're going to look at, yes?
What determines the measure that you choose y over? Is it just uniform over all possibilities?
It's designed.
Okay.
It's designed so that you collapse at the peaks of the wave.
Sure.
And another point. I mean, you want to choose, I guess. You want T to be large, so you want there to be large time intervals between collapses for a single state. But you want a lot of collapses. You want the A to be small. So if you have a macro system, there's a lot of atoms here, and one of them will collapse. But if you have one small quantum state, it'll be a long time until you expect that to stochastically collapse. So we're going to put this on a lattice. It's a nice, simple, finite system. You avoid the complexities of path integrals and so on. So what have we got here? It's called the null lattice. Minkowski null lattice, 1 plus 1 null lattice. It's got two components. You've got vertices, points here, and you've got links joining the vertices. I'm also going to identify the left-hand side and the right-hand side of this picture to make it a cylinder. Now, you have a set of unrelated links we think of as a space-like hypersurface. So here, you've got sigma n. This is going to evolve forward step by step by going across a vertex. How do we add in the dynamics? Well, we put on each link a qubit. So you've got a Hilbert space with basis 0 or 1 on each link. And we put a evolution operator on the vertex. And as we, and the, so then this, the Hilbert space on the whole hypersurface is going to be formed from tensor products of Hilbert spaces of the links it goes through, it cuts across. As we move across one vertex, we're going to operate on the parts of the state coming from these two links with the operator here, and we're going to get out the part of the state here. So standard quantum mechanics, we start with an initial state, chi naught, on the initial surface. We do this in any linear order that's compatible with the partial order on the lattice, and you can show that the ordering does not matter. So we pick an ordering, then we operate by R1, then R2, and so on, and then we get our final state, chi n. Then we're going to introduce a stochastic collapse process. This is going to operate on the links. So in a sense, after we've evolved across this vertex, we then say on vertex, sorry, on link 1', we then operate on the state there with either J naught or J1. These are our Krauss operators. As you can see, this is a sum of two projectors, a projector onto the, we choose our basis so that the zero, you know, the 0, 1 is whatever, the zero state. So this is a projector onto the 0, 1 state plus x times a projector onto the, sorry, the 1, 0 state, and x times projector onto the 0, 1 state. The x is going to be less than 1, and then we're going to normalize. The x is less than 1, so it's a sum of two projectors, one of which is suppressed. J1 is just the opposite. You're suppressing the other projector. So if I write that out for you, if you have P0 equals 1 then J0 is going to be normalized P0 plus X. Now, in our new dynamics, we evolve over a vertex, then we see a partial collapse. Then we evolve over another vertex, then we see another partial collapse, and so on, and then we normalize at the end. What do we collapse onto? Onto 0 or 1? Well, we're just going to call this A1. A1 could either be 0 or 1. This string of bits, AI, is going to be a classical history. So this string of bits will determine what the final state is. And the probability of getting this string of bits A is determined by the final history you get. Now, this is suggestive of the histories approach. As you can see, again, you've got two processes. You've got this sort of quantum process going on with these R matrices, but then you've got the choice of the AI, and that's going to be stochastic.
Do you leave out the normalization, M?
Yes. So we've got two processes here. One is phrased in terms of histories, and one is, so we're going to try and phrase everything in the histories framework. That's what we get.
So firstly, I'm showing you here several decoherence functionals. I stress that the entries to these functionals are going to be single elements at the moment. I'm not giving you sets. You get the full decoherence functional by summing. It's just easier to write this way. So standard quantum mechanics, how's that phrased? Well, you start at your initial state, you evolve over a vertex, you project onto value psi 1, this should read p1, then you evolve over the second vertex, you project onto psi 2, and so on. This gives you the final state corresponding to history psi. You do the same with the history phi, and you take the cross term. This is going to give you your matrix entry. What does this look like? What does the stochastic collapse process look like for the classical history? Well, again, you just work through the dynamics. You start with your initial state. You go over your first vertex. Again, there should be a 1. You implement your partial collapse according to A1, and so on. Similarly, you do the same with B1, and you take the cross term. However, we want this to be stochastic, so we're going to force A and B to be the same. We're going to force decoherence. Okay. Now, the next step is key. We're going to put these two together, and we're going to find a decoherence functional which includes both the classical and the quantum histories. It phrases them, puts them both on the same level. It's going to be DQC here. And it turns out that this is simply the quantum mechanics decoherence functional multiplied by this object here. Now, dA psi, what is that? Well, A is a string of bits, strings of ones and zeros. Psi is also a string of ones and zeros. dA psi is the number of differences between those two strings. Similarly, dB phi is the number of differences between the string B and the string phi. So essentially, what our stochastic collapse process is doing is suppressing the decoherence functional by this factor. And again, remember, x is less than 1, so you're suppressing it according to the number of places where a is different to psi and b is different to phi. Then you're imposing a equals b. Now, yeah, I'm sorry I don't have enough time to explain fully the way you get decoherence and summing out from, but you would get this from this by summing over the quantum histories. And I don't think I've really got time to go into that. So if you don't know what that means, you'll have to ask me afterwards. We can then ask what happens if we sum out the classical histories, if we trace out the classical histories. We then get an alternative quantum decoherence functional. And this is really what stochastic collapse does to the quantum histories. You just have the standard quantum mechanics decoherence functional, but you're suppressing the off-diagonal terms. Now, this raises several issues. Firstly, though I haven't shown it here because of lack of time, you can reformulate this decoherence functional completely in terms of standard quantum mechanics by introducing an environment which consists of a qubit state on each link. Because of that, you can then fully express stochastic collapse in terms of a fully quantum system without this sort of classical collapse process occurring. Then there's a question, why should you use the extra structure associated with stochastic collapse? I guess the answer would be that the form of environment that you're forced to take could be considered to be extremely inelegant. So you have, in a sense, a subjective choice between what you find least appealing. Do you find the inelegance of the environment least appealing, or do you find the need to add this extra stochastic collapse process onto quantum mechanics, less appealing. Also, you have a question of coupling systems. Now, your sample space splits into two isomorphic parts. So you've got your psi history, string of ones and zeros, and you've got your AB history, your classical history, string of ones and zeros telling you whether the J operator was a J0 or a J1. Now, if you followed Bell's interpretation of the GRW model or stochastic collapse models in total, you really want to think of these classical histories as the real objects, and you want to think of the quantum histories as just a computational tool you use to generate your probability distributions. However, and the way you would achieve that is by tracing out omega q. However, you couple systems through omega q. So you would have this odd situation where you considered omega q was not real, but whenever you wanted to consider subsystems or to try and put two subsystems together, you'd have to do it through this non-real omega q. Okay. These are just some issues that are highlighted by looking at stochastic collapse in, or phrasing stochastic collapse in a history's language. And I'm now going to, again, there's more that could be said on this, but for lack of time, I have to end that here. I'm now going to go into the second part of the talk. I'm going to look at interpretational questions. So what we're going to do here is we're going to try and take across, or the way I view this program, we're going to try and take across as much of the structure of stochastic collapse, much of the structure of classical stochastic mechanics as we can into quantum mechanics. Now I'm going to go through quantum measure theory and what is called anhomomorphic logic. These are approaches to quantum mechanics that, as I said earlier, were thought up by Raphael Sorkin. I've been working in particular on what gets called anhomomorphic logic. So, first we're going to look at classical stochastic mechanics. How does this work? Well, you have a sample space omega, you have an event algebra A. In the finite case, A is the set of subsets of your sample space. The dynamics is given by a probability measure, P. P maps each of your events to R, gives you the probability. The probability is always greater than or equal to zero, and you have the Kolmogorov sum rule. So the probability of A disjoint union B is the probability of A plus the probability of B. Phrasing this in Hegelian history's language, if you had a quantum mechanics system that was behaving classically, this would be because the decoherence functional, the matrix, would be diagonal. You would have no interference between different histories. Now, how do you interpret this? How do you interpret classical mechanics? Well, one history, let's call it R, is the real history. History R actually happens. Now, I'm going to rephrase this concept and that in the dual sense, and that's what we're going to take across to quantum mechanics. So instead of R, I'm going to look at, instead of the event R, I'm going to look at the co-event R star. So R star maps omega to Z2. R star of alpha is 1 if and only if R equals alpha. So this is a map to Z2 that picks out the real history. And we're going to extend this to a map on the event algebra. R star maps A to 1 if and only if R is in the set A. So if you think of this set A as representing some property of the system, let's say in the case where you can have multiple pods, the set A may be the proposition that the path passes through the upper slit, then what R star does is it asks the question, is the real history in this set? So is the real history, in if
if we call this the real history, then the real history goes through the upper slit. So R star of B will be 0, R star of A will be 1. How do we relate this to the dynamics? We're going to relate this to the dynamics through the concept of preclusion. If the probability of an event is 0, then the real history cannot lie inside that event. I think mathematically, R is going to be a homomorphism between the event algebra and Z2. In fact, the set of R stars is going to generate this whole, or it's going to be this whole set of homomorphisms. Now, how much of this structure can we take across to quantum mechanics? Well, normally, probability of A is going to be DAA when the system's behaving classically, given decoherence. So this is going to suggest what I'm going to call the quantum measure, mu A, to be DAA in general. So what are the properties of this object? So mu is, again, is real valued, positive. How we lose the Kolmogorov sum rule. And how does this occur? Well, you can think of this in terms of a hierarchy of interference terms. I1, I2, I3, IN. Classical stochastics, classical mechanics obeys I2 equals 0. Quantum mechanics does not. However, quantum mechanics is not unconstrained. It does obey I3 equals 0. Okay, so that's how we generalize the dynamics. Now, how are we going to generalize the interpretation? This is a far more subtle issue. Now, those R stars we talked about, homomorphisms between the algebra and Z2, which are the classical coefficients, these are too restrictive for quantum mechanics, as can be shown by examples such as the Kirchner-Specker system, which, if we have time, we'll talk about later. So we're going to generalize this. We're going to weaken some of the axioms. We're going to generalize this to home star AZ2. So this is the space of, that's wrong, space of maps preserving multiplication, but not necessarily preserving addition. So remember, A has an algebraic structure given by symmetric difference as addition, intersection as multiplication. Z2 has a very simple algebraic structure. So phi of AB, or A intersection B, is going to equal phi A, phi B. Further, phi of A, because of this, phi of A being 1 is going to imply that phi of B is 1, for B includes A. So essentially, if A is going to be mapped to 1, everything including A is going to be mapped to 1 by these maps. And given a set A, we can construct the dual coevent A star. So remember, previously, given a single history R, we constructed the dual coevent R star. We're now going to extend this concept to sets. We're going to define A star B is 1 if A is inside B, 0 otherwise. So graphically, what does this mean? If we have our sample space here, and we've got a set A here. Previously, we had one history here. Previously, we had one history, R, here. So if R is in A, A is true. R is not in B, and it's not in C, so B and C are not true. Now we're going to use all of A. We're going to do what I'm calling ontological coarse graining here. Instead of R representing the real history, all of A is going to represent the real history. Now, and we're going to apply similar logic to the classical case. Because A is not in C, C does not occur. And because A is not entirely in B, B does not occur either. So in this scheme, if A star, the coevent, is our reality, only the properties that are common to all of the histories in that set can be thought of as real. But because of this, we lose one, I guess, axiom of ordinary logic. We now can have, if you look at B here, B is not true, but neither is, B is false, but the complement of B is also false. So this is the one adjustment we make. This is the one compromise we have to make to our normal classical understanding of this interpretation to be able to deal with quantum mechanics. Now, as before, we're going to relate our interpretation to the dynamics by demanding what we call preclusivity. If the measure of a set is zero, then the coevent, a real coevent, must map that to zero. We also have this concept of primitivity. Coevents must be as detailed as possible, subject to preclusivity. So if A is preclusive, if A is a legal coevent and D is legal, then we're going to claim that A dominates D, A is inside D. So A is going to be an allowed real set, real coevent, A star. D star is not going to be allowed. Right. Let's see if I can deal with the Koch and Specker system in this. Now, is this roughly clear to everyone? Good. So what is the Koch and Specker theorem? Koch and Specker theorem concerns cryptodeterministic theories. I found that word in Asher Perez's paper, and it sounded cool, so I had to include it in this talk. It concerns hidden variable theories that non-contextually attribute a definite result to each quantum measurement before the measurement is taken. So this measurement is seen as discovering a result that's already there. So the Koch and Specker theorem deals with that sort of theory. We rule out those sorts of theories for systems described by Hilbert spaces of dimension 3 or greater. How is this shown? Well, Koch and Specker in their paper, they take a set of 117 rays in R3 with every basis in this set corresponds to a possible experiment. This experiment will label one of the rays 1, well, one of the, you know, as in standard quantum mechanics, one of the vectors in the basis will occur and two will not. So one of these rays is labeled with 1, and the other two rays can be labeled with a 0. In a non-contextual deterministic theory, this labeling is already there and is discovered by your measurements. Further, non-contextuality means the labelings should be consistent. Thus, any non-contextual deterministic theory will label each of the rays, each of these 117 rays, 1 or 0, such that no pair of orthogonal rays should be both labeled 1, and every basis should have one ray labeled 1 and two rays labeled 0. This just comes from quantum mechanics. And the Koch and Specker theorem shows that such a labeling does not exist. They sort of chase around this diagram. Perez rays. Perez simplifies this process using a set of only 33 rays in R cubed. The Perez rays make up 16 orthogonal bases. And in fact, these are the rays. You join the center of the cube to all these dots, and you have the rays. This set has very crucial symmetries, which simplify the proof. So it's invariant under rotations and reflections. This set is minimal. Removing any single ray from this set will mess up proof. Let me try and talk you through this proof very quickly. So these are the rays. I've taken this from Perez's paper. His notation is a little non-standard. 2 actually means root 2, and bar means minus. So this is minus root 2 naught 1. Well, 1 also means root 1. And oh. illuminated the problem. So this is, in a sense, this is diagram chasing, ray chasing, basis chasing. You go around all the rays, and you try and create a consistent labeling. You only need to look at one possibility because of the symmetries of the set. So firstly, you take the coordinate axes, x, y, z. You label one of them 1, or using Peres' terminology, you label one green and the other two red. Now, you do that without loss of generality. If you'd have taken the y to be green rather than the z, you could have just done a rotation. Your next choice corresponds to a choice of x versus minus x, then a choice of y versus minus y, then a choice of x versus y. So if you'd have made any of these four first choices differently, this would correspond to a rotation or reflection of the set. So you can make these first choices without loss of generality. However, these first four choices determine the choices for the remaining elements. So here you have to pick this because this is going to be orthogonal. This is going to be orthogonal to this. This is going to be orthogonal to this. So these two have already been ruled out. You have to pick this. You go chase down all the remaining bases in this way, and you find that on the last basis that's not shown, you're forced to label all three red. So in this way, it's very simple to see that there's no consistent labeling of the Peres set. Now I want to phrase this in terms of history's language. So I want to produce a decoherence functional for this, a quantum measure, and I want to try and explain this or describe this system using coevents, just as a showcase of the power of anhomomorphic logic, or whatever you want to call it. So to apply quantum measure theory, you've got to phrase this in terms of space-time paths. The obvious way to do this is in terms of Stern-Gerlach apparati. I'm going to assume everyone knows what they are. You apply an inhomogeneous magnetic field. You can split you can split the beam of a particle according to spin. I'm going to do a Gedanken experiment. I'm not sure if this is actually possible, but you can use a spin one particle, so you can get three beams. It's going to correspond to your basis. Now, what we're going to do, we can, instead of looking at spin, we're going to think about spin squared. You can do this by ignoring the difference between the top and the bottom beam. Why do we do this? Well, spin squared commutes. So in three dimensions, orthogonal spin squared commutes. We have eigenvalues 0, one dimensional, and 1, two dimensional. So we're going to set up a sequence of 33 of these apparatuses with the fields in directions corresponding to the Peres rays. Each spin squared will correspond to a labeling of the Peres rays. So if the path goes through the middle, that's a zero eigenvalue for the spin squared in that direction. We're going to label the direction B1 of this beam. We're going to label that direction green in Peres' scheme. If it goes through either of these other two branches, we're going to label that red. Because this spin squared commutes here, if the B's here being the directions, say the directions of the magnetic beam, it could be coming out of the board, it could be going this way. If these are vectors representing the directions of the magnetic field, and if the B, 1, 2, 3 form a basis, because these things commute, we know that exactly one of these three will be green and the other two must be red. Now, this does not occur if this basis is mixed in with other Stern-Gerlachs. However, let's say these two form a pair, and this is just some arbitrary vector in the middle. in terms of decoherence functionals, you can sum out over the different possibilities here, and then you will get a measure zero set corresponding to this being traced out. I can tell you more about that afterwards. I'm running out of time, so I don't want to go into that in greater length. So chaos contradiction in history's language. In the proof of the Koken-Specker theorem I just showed you, there are two possible contradictions. An orthogonal pair of rays, both of which are labeled green, an orthogonal triple of rays, a basis, all three of which are labeled red. So correspondingly, we can construct two types of problem sets corresponding to these contradictions. For an orthogonal pair of rays, V1, V2, we can let GP be the set of all paths labeling both members of P green. Similarly, for an orthogonal triple, B is V1 to 3, I'm going to let RB be the set of all paths labeling the members of B red. Now, because spin squared commutes, these sets are going to be precluded. So omega of GP is going to be 0, and omega of RB is going to be also going to be 0. Thus, in this language, the Koken-Specker theorem tells us that every path gamma is a member of a precluded set. Why does it do that? Well, we showed, chasing down that diagram, we started by assuming there were no contradictions on any basis or any pair, and we found that we were forced to assume, we were forced to find a basis, the end, all three of whose rays were labeled red. The Peres formalism of the Koken-Specker theorem tells us that every path is a member of a precluded set. So if we used the classical interpretation of quantum measure theory, i.e. that exactly one path occurs, you have R, your real path, you'd have to conclude that nothing can occur. Because we'd already stated that if P of A is zero, if you remember going back to here, remember P of A being zero means that R star of A is zero. But if every single path is an element of a measure zero set, then every single path is going to be precluded. So in this framework, the Koken-Specker contradiction tells us that essentially nothing can happen. No history can be real. There's no reality, is precisely what I'd like to say. However, using the Koven scheme I described earlier, it is possible to successfully describe this system. With one caveat, these sets are of measure zero. However, you also introduce a number of what I call accidental measure zero sets, which are order dependent, depending on the initial state of the system and on the exact order of your 33 Stern-Gerlach systems. Because the sample space is so large, you can't be absolutely sure of having dealt with all of these measure zero sets. Now, you can find coevents that successfully describe the system if you think of only these types of sets as measure zero. And again, I've got to rush to the end, and I can answer more questions on that afterwards. So coming up the last two slides, how do coevents describe this system? Well, let gamma A be the path defined by the Peres rays in the table I showed here. So gamma A is the path that labels goes through the Stern-Gerlach, as would label these rays green. This has a contradiction on the basis A. So this path labels all three of these rays red. It has no other contradictions. Thus, the coevent corresponding to that element is in RB if and only if A is B, but it's not in any GP. But yet that means that the set A, well, this should read RA. The set RA is sent to 1, but the set RA is of measure 0. So this coevent is not preclusive. So it's not an admissible description of reality. However, we can find a preclusive one. We act on the Peretz set with any symmetry. We send the basis A to the basis A dash. And so we send the labeling the path gamma to the path gamma dash, gamma A dash. Then we find that the coevent corresponding to the set of these two is preclusive. So gamma A will not be preclusive because it will be in RA. Gamma A dash will not be preclusive. Gamma dash star will not be preclusive because gamma A dash is going to be in RA dash. However, this set is not in any measure zero set, so the corresponding coevent is preclusive. I'm going to wrap up because I've gone over time. I'm going to have to skip this to show this to you after. I think I've gone a little bit over time, but what does this coevent look like? Does it give a satisfactory account of reality? Well, you have, so here we have all the rays, and we see this is gamma A, this is gamma, a choice of gamma A dash. We see here which rays are labeled green and which are labeled red by the two paths. And this is the coevent asking the question, is this ray labeled green? Or is this ray labeled red? In most cases, you get a Boolean answer. So you ask, not, not one, is it green? Yes. Is it red? No. One, not one, is it green? No. Is it red? Yes. However, for some rays, here we are, for minus one, one, root two, is it green? No. Is it red? No. This is the non-class, this is where the non-classicality comes out. You've got to have some non-classicality. And this is the property that we discussed earlier, if you think back to this diagram, that psi m of A and psi m of A dash, a complement of A, can both be zero. Now, will we ever see this non-classicality? The short answer is no. You can demonstrate that we have a theorem showing that in classical-looking systems, in classical-looking subalgebras, this coevent restricts to a homomorphism, so it restricts to a classical coevent. And just to wrap up by looking at ongoing work, we're looking at other systems. Cole and Raphael are looking at Hardy box. Another possible system to look at is the GHZ system. Another question is time evolution for coevents. Will you get premonitions, that's effects, like a causal effect. There are other possible coevent schemes. So rather than just removing addition and keeping multiplication, there are more complicated suggestions. And then it's expected that this scheme will contribute to causal set theory, where we need a causality condition to replace what's called Bell causality. And then, as I promised at the beginning, I'll just tell you the references. This is our paper, which should be out next week. The foundational paper, the GRW paper, a couple of papers describing the discrete collapse model, the null lattice, and a couple of papers describing sort of single particle quantum mechanics, stochastic collapse models for single particle quantum mechanics. In the coevents, this is our paper, looking at the co-conspector system. The sort of foundational paper on quantum measure theory, foundational paper on what's now called anhomomorphic logic, then the co-conspector paper, the Peretz paper, this is a short paper that's worth looking through, and then some references about Stern-Gerlach systems. And I'd like to end there. Sorry, I've gone a bit over time. Do I have time for questions?
Great question. Okay. on the subject of the histories approach then for a quick question. So I understand that some of the people who formulated histories, like Robert Griffiths or so forth, they wouldn't believe that you would need any kind of additional stochastic dynamics to make the histories formalism work. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I could be quite anthropomorphic logic and say yes and no, no and yes. I think there's a very different approach there. Normal decoherent histories, you're looking for, you just take a different approach. You take the decoherence function off, then you look at a coarse graining that's classical. Right? So there are certain, if you take the matrix, you can take certain coarse grainings, if you sum these elements up, you can take certain coarse grainings which give you a classical sort of subsystem. Now, this is usually what they do with it. And the problem with this approach being that there's more than one way to do this. And so you get different sets of questions that you can ask, which might sort of contradict each other. I don't do that. I take the whole decoherence function. So it's just a different approach. And then you need more interpretation.
Just a comment. You referred to the three-way generalization of the Kolmogorov sum rule, which is characteristic of quantum mechanics. People might be interested that over at IQC this is being tested with a three-slip diffraction experiment. And I'm sure if you went over there, they'd love to show you the lab, which is a really nice setup.
Okay, let's
thank the
speaker again.